the joy of teaching is really getting students to share themselves, right? Like, and especially with our multilingual learners, who we really want to create opportunities for them to share that self. So if we don't create the space for that, then we're going to be missing a huge part of the joy of teaching, I think.
Kia ora, everybody. Welcome back to Highest Aspirations, an education podcast focused on providing educators with inspiration and strategies to help multilingual learners achieve their highest aspirations. I'm your host, Steve Sofronis, recording this intro from the North Island of New Zealand, where I've had the opportunity to spend some time exploring while visiting friends and learning a lot about the Māori language and culture. I opened with the greeting, Ki ora. It has been incredibly inspiring to see the efforts being made here to preserve Indigenous language and culture and embed them into daily life in schools and communities. We can make a strong connection between that observation and the topics covered in this week's episode with our friends Diane Stair-Fenner and Sydney Snyder. Under the umbrella of teaching and learning academic language, we talk a lot about the need to bring in sociocultural context and background knowledge that our students bring with them. We also get into how we can avoid taking a one-size-fits-all approach and personalize learning to accelerate learning. Of course, Diane and Sydney also share some simple and effective strategies from their book, Unlocking Multilingual Learners' Potential: Strategies for Making Content Accessible. These are strategies that you can start using right away, and you can dive into the book for more information. Diane Stair-Fenner is the author of 8 books on multilingual learner education, including the co-author of Unlocking Multilingual Learners' Potential: Strategies for Making Content Accessible, and Culturally Responsive Teaching for Multilingual Learners: Tools for Equity, second edition. She's a former ELD teacher and the founder and president of Support Ed, a woman-owned small business that provides professional development, technical assistance, and curriculum support to empower multilingual learners and their educators. Sydney Snyder is the co-author of Unlocking Multilingual Learners' Potential: Strategies for Making Content Accessible, and the other book that was already mentioned, Culturally Responsive Teaching for Multilingual Learners: Tools for Equity. She is a principal associate at Support Ed. In this role, she provides professional development, coaching, and technical assistance to educators framed around advocacy and educational equity for multilingual learners and their families. With that, I hope you enjoy our conversation with Diane Stair-Fenner and Sydney Snyder. Diane Stair-Fenner and Sydney Snyder, thank you so much for joining us on Highest Aspirations.
Thanks so much for having
me. Yeah, thank you. We're happy to be here.
I love it. When you both say you're happy to be here at the same time at the very beginning, that means we're off to a really good start. So Diane, you and I have talked a lot over the years. We did some work together during COVID when we were trying to put together some resources that would provide equitable education to multilingual learners. And I'm really happy that we're finally able to do this and talk some more about the work that you're doing in Sydney. We just met, but I'm excited to have you on board as well and talk about the work that you're doing. So I want to start by level setting with both of you about some terminology, because the terminology in this field can be overwhelming for folks. So some people, you may be able to skip ahead, but others, I just want to kind of level set and make sure we're good to go on the terminology. So take a moment to define what you mean by two really important sort of terms that we're going to use in this episode. And one is sentence level and one is discourse level.
Great. So I'm going to start off, I'm Diane Stair-Fenner, and I'm going to start off with a little bit about sentence level, and then Sydney will share about discourse level.
Great.
So just giving a little bit more context, our framework for sentence level and discourse level academic language is based on the WIDA 2020 English Language Development Standards. Mm-hmm. So, and just a little bit about, you know, why we did this. So we delved deeper into these two levels since we noticed this is an area in which a lot of teachers need additional support. Teachers usually feel more comfortable working with vocabulary, so word and phrase level, but we wanted to explore more sentence and discourse level work to support teachers. So that said, sentence level, it really looks at the grammar and syntax that multilingual learners need to acquire academic language and to be able to access complex tasks, mm-hmm, and concepts. So, and to be able to also engage with their peers and teachers. And so WIDA defined sentence level academic language as grammatical complexity of language. And it includes simple, complex, compound sentences, coordinating and subordinating conjunctions, dependent and independent clauses. And that was a mouthful.
Yeah.
That's a lot of grammar talk.
That is a lot of grammar. Yeah.
Yeah. So we really don't want teachers to be afraid of the grammar or feel overwhelmed by that. So we're glad that later on, we're going to be talking about very specific strategies of how these can be applied.
Absolutely. I'm a bit of a grammar nerd, so this is all like music to my ears. It reminds me of my classroom days. But yes, I was just going to say, we will dive in to that. Sorry to interrupt, Sydney. You wanted to talk, I think, about the discourse level.
Right. So discourse is really how texts are organized. And when we say text, it could be like an essay, but it could also be a speech, or, you know, there's that oral aspect to it. So we want to have a broad definition of what text can be. So how do ideas hang together throughout a text? And what are the cohesive devices that are used? Basically, when we're thinking about our multilingual learners, we want them to think about how, for example, does a poem look different than a lab report? Mm-hmm. And we want that not only so that they're able to access those and digest those when they're engaging with different type of texts, but also when they're producing that, so that they know those features, those discourse features, and they're able to use them in their production. Ouida also talks about genre families. So thinking about how a descriptive text is going to look different from a persuasive text, for example. And again, those are aspects that we want students to be familiar with.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, Diane, you started by talking about teachers are often comfortable with kind of the vocabulary. And I go back to like my days of teaching that were not very effective at the very beginning when I was using these vocabulary lists and giving quizzes every week. I'll own it. I did that. It was not effective.
We all did. It's okay.
Thank you for validating. I was waiting for that. And so it was easy. Right. It wasn't hard to do. I had to sort of find a list of vocabulary. I think what I did decently is I was able to find the vocabulary that I thought I taught Spanish as a foreign language. So I was able to find the vocabulary that I knew my students would need for a specific theme or topic or something we were reading or doing. It took me a long time to get beyond that. And even when I did get beyond that, I was probably doing a lot of the things that you were just talking about at the sentence and discourse level, but I didn't have a structure for it. I didn't have any definitions for it. And that's why I think that this conversation is really important. Even for those teachers who are doing it to sort of, it's not just a label, right? It's like a structure to follow, which I think is really important, which kind of leads me to my next question. And that is that, like, and I'll preface it by saying that we talk a lot about academic language on the podcast and obviously at Elevation in general. I know you do too. And one thing that we know is it can be really tricky. It can be ambiguous, which is not uncommon in many topics in education. And it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And the landscape is constantly changing. So given that context, my question is, how should educators go about increasing their awareness of the academic language that their students need to access content? I led this by saying, like, I was pretty good at finding out the vocabulary that the students needed. But how do you take that to the next level and sort of personalize it for your own students?
Right. Yeah. And you really hit the nail on the head. It can be tricky. It can be ambiguous. And we, you know, our books and our work are all about developing practical tools for teachers, because we've been in the classroom before and we know that we don't want teachers to have to reinvent the wheel all of the time. So, you know, we've developed a few tools to help teachers, you know, figure out, to help them have a framework for where do they want to begin, what their entry point will be with academic language. Not everybody's a grammar nerd like you were, Steve. So, you know, a lot of teachers do need some extra support to feel better and to feel like a little bit more comfortable with working at sentence level, grammar and syntax, for example. So raising awareness about what you want to prioritize, what you want to focus on is really key. And we always suggest that teachers raise awareness. They determine what their priority area or areas might be at the sentence and discourse levels with academic language, and that they embed mini lessons into their instruction of content and language for multilingual learners. They're crucial and critical for MLs, but they're going to benefit all students having this extra support. So that said, so there are a couple of tools that really help raise awareness. And one is called a checklist. This is also very catchy. Checklist for increasing academic language awareness. And to really helps teachers understand the academic language demands of a text that they're going to be working with at all different levels. And so they can then determine what features of academic language are going to be important to teach. And then our second tool is called a checklist for supporting multilingual learners academic language development, specifically in speaking and writing, really, you know, zeroing in on those two modalities, those two domains of language. And it helps teachers brainstorm how they can integrate academic language instruction in these areas. So we always share that teachers shouldn't use these tools in isolation. They should be within a framework of collaboration. And so these tools really help support English language development or ELD teachers and content teachers to come together and to brainstorm and prioritize and plan together. And we also really implore our administrators to set aside a time and space for this collaboration to happen. And so in this way, they can co-construct and decide on what's the essential language that our multilingual learners need to engage with their content. And so another area we want teachers to be able to collaborate around is developing language objectives that are aligned to content goals and objectives. So what do students need to be able to do with language to effectively demonstrate their understanding of the content? So do they have to argue, explain, compare, for example? So our tools will help teachers really have these important conversations to help move our multilingual language learners forward in acquiring language and content.
Yeah. And I'll say like, Sydney, if you have anything to add, jump in anytime, but I wanted to say that in the book, Unlocking Multilingual Learners' Potential, the second edition, I read the chapter that we're sort of referring to today. And like, I really wanted you to talk about those checklists because for me, as I said earlier, like as somebody who I think kind of figured this out on my own a little bit to an extent, certainly not to the extent that you have written in the book, those checklists were like really, really useful for me. So I just want to reiterate that those are super useful and very user-friendly as well. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the book in every chapter has those and follows that same sort of pattern, which I think is great. And then I'll let you respond in a second, but I also just, before I forget, the collaboration piece, we're going to get to that next. Talk a bit like about how we not work in silos. So I want to make sure that folks know that we're going to dive into that as well a little bit more in more detail. But I want to give you a chance to respond to what I said about the chapters, make sure I'm right, and just maybe give folks like an idea of how they're set up.
Right. Yeah. Every chapter does have a good number of checklists that help readers to take the content and apply it to their context. And what we really like with the second edition of this book, we've structured it in a way where as teachers work through the book and work through each chapter, at the end, they'll walk away with a complete unit already planned out that incorporates all of the aspects of the book. So again, you know, our work is really grounded in making sure it's practical for teachers, that they can take the information and use it the next day in their classroom.
Great. Sydney, I don't want to leave you out of the conversation. Anything to add there? I'm sure we'll get to you in a second, but
I just wanted to say that one of the goals of this focus on academic language is really trying to shift it so it's at the beginning of the planning rather than an add-on, right? So how are we really approaching planning, thinking about language development, and not just the vocabulary piece, but that sentence and discourse piece also?
Great. Yeah, really good point. And adding to that piece, like just as language and content, as you just said, shouldn't be approached in silos, and both the language and content should be, you know, brought up throughout the lesson, not one or the other. The same is the case with sociocultural context, which you talk about as well. So I want to get into that a little bit. What strategies can educators use to bring in that background knowledge and make content more approachable to a variety of cultures? We talk about this all the time, activate background knowledge. But I think it's one of those things, like many of the other sort of buzzwords that we have, that like we hear about it all the time. But what can we do to make sure that we're doing it, particularly when we have students from such a wide variety of cultures?
Yeah, that's such a great question and an important point. So we really have at a foundation of our work is that our students come to us with assets. So we always want to be starting with what they're bringing to the classroom.
By the way, I was going to say, and I can't resist, I'm going to say it because I can't resist. Another one of those sort of buzzwords that we hear all the time is asset-based approach, which is great and phenomenal. But I'm excited because now you're going to get into what it is that we can do to take advantage of those assets and make the content more approachable. Sorry, I couldn't resist because I was going to say that right before you said it.
No, I think that's so true, right? What does that really mean?
Exactly.
And I think what it means is we know our students very well, so we know we're able to bring in what their prior experiences, we're able to bring in their culture. And part of that that goes along with that is assessing their background knowledge first. So then we know, okay, this is what they already have. This is our starting point. Or we're activating what they have. And then from there, we can move on to fill in maybe, oh, we need to provide a little bit more background in this area because this is something that they're not bringing to the classroom. So a couple of our favorite ways to really like assess and activate that background knowledge is through the use of images. So having students look at images for the content they're going to be discussing and then working in pairs, because we always want that work to be collaborative, right? Discussing what do they see in the images? What does it remind them of? What questions do they have? You know, Harvard Project Zero has that. I see, I think, I wonder. So it could be that or a variation of that. It could be a gallery walk where they're looking at images and adding comments as they walk around in pairs. So I think images are a great way to kind of assess and activate that background knowledge. Another great way is through the idea of a concept sort, where you can have different either key phrases, and you might even include visuals if you have students that are at lower levels of proficiency, and you ask them to work in pairs or groups to sort into categories. And it could be categories you're providing connected to the content, or you could ask them, once they're familiar, they could come up with their own categories. But again, you're looking for, oh, what ideas do they already have about this topic? What are they already bringing? What misconceptions do they have? And then that can really guide your work. Another really important thing that we think is really checking in with students about what works well from them. So when you try out these strategies, you know, ask them, how did you like this? Did this help you start thinking about this topic we're going to be exploring? You know, what could we do differently to really make clear to students the goals of those activities?
Yeah. Particularly love the last one. Just quick surveys. Those can be exit tickets, and you can do it in a variety of different ways, but I think that's great. Or just informal conversations, like you mentioned. The images, I have to kind of bring back another personal experience that I had. And again, this is teaching Spanish as a foreign language, but I used to use images, and this is kind of a funny story. I think it'll age me a little bit, but like I started teaching a long time ago, and I taught for 17 years. And when I was teaching, people were still using those, when I started, those overhead projectors with like the transparent screens. People who are younger may not even know what that is, but you're both sort of nodding, so you know what I'm talking about. And they started to throw them away because we got better technology. I refused to throw them away because what I loved about them was, first of all, the kids would look at it like it was like this funny thing, like this dinosaur that we were using from the past. They'd be like, ooh, what's that thing? And there was some kind of like nostalgic, or not even nostalgic, just some excitement about this old tool. But with images, it was fun to put the little transparent piece on. You could kind of draw on it. I know you can do this all digitally. I get it. But like, I put a piece of paper over a part of the image so I'd hide it. And then you could slowly kind of manually show more parts of it. And it built that curiosity. And I think, you know, there's obviously ways to do that now that are probably far easier and more efficient with technology. But I used to love doing that. It was such a great, it was always effective in building curiosity, just taking one piece and then slowly moving it, especially if it was a surprising image. So I had to.
Sounds like it was like the big reveal at the end, right? So yeah, you're just like fostering that excitement. And that's something we want to do for our multilingual learners all of the time. And so using these images to figure out, you know, to help figure out what they're coming with in terms of their background knowledge doesn't take a long time. In our chapter in our book about background knowledge, we really stress that we want it to be concise, right? We want to get to the learning. We want to build that excitement, but then have them keep developing their engagement with content and not just like giving them everything they're going to learn in the upcoming unit or text.
Yeah, exactly. And training them that they should be part of the learning, right? That's another important piece over time. So I think we're kind of doing this now, but I want to get into some strategies, like some of your favorites. So I kind of have two questions here, but I'll blend them into one. And that is like, I'd love to hear, going back to the teaching academic language at the sentence level and teaching academic language at the discourse level. What are one or two of your sort of favorite strategies each one? So people can kind of walk away with some ideas. And then I always say the purpose of this pod, if you're listening to this, you're not going to remember everything, but maybe this will guide you to go somewhere to actually implement this.
Yeah, great. So I'll do a couple about the sentence level, and then Sydney will share a couple on the discourse level. So I guess I'm the sentence lady.
Perfect.
So I'll share like one of our first go-tos that we love, that we adapted and from Wong Fillmore, and Fillmore is Unpacking Juicy Sentences. There are different ways to do this, but it really helps you find a challenging or a complex sentence in an authentic text, and you help students focus on it and break it down and help them deconstruct it and then reconstruct it in their own words. So we, as Sydney shared, we want them working together, and they're chunking in their own words a complex sentence. To then, it really heightens their awareness of the structures of the sentence, how language helps them make meaning from that sentence. They can do this in a gallery walk. They can compare each other's sentences. They can incorporate visuals to really have it be their own and to be creative. And also, we want to encourage them, when appropriate, to use home language as well to really support this work, to make meaning of English at the sentence level.
Love that.
Yeah. And another strategy we love is from Katie Topple, which is called Structured Sentence Books. So she is very intentional about creating some sentence frames or sentence stems that really encourage students to use a structure that she wants. Like, let's say a complex sentence, a cause and effect sentence. And then she has individual pieces of paper that students fill in to really construct more complex ideas. And these stems are all related to the content being taught or a text the students are working on. And then she compiles these individual pieces into a book, so then students can see each other's work. And it's really helping them become more familiar with the construct that she wants to teach.
Love that. And that, I just hit on that a little bit. I'm familiar with Katie Topple's work. We've collaborated a little bit in the past. And that, like, that's another example of going beyond the vocabulary list and having a structure. Somebody's done that work really, really well, and now you can steal it and it's totally fine. And I think that's really, really not a nice way to kind of get at that complex stuff. That's hard to do. You need to create all those structures, but don't reinvent the wheel. They've already been created, and they've been created by somebody who does really great work with it.
Yeah. And it's not stealing if you cite their work. So we love Katie's work and we cite her, and she's in our new book. So
great. 100%. Thanks for adding that on. Yeah. I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want Katie to come after me.
I also, something that I really appreciate about that strategy is I think that sentence stems are used a lot as a scaffold. We see them in a lot of classes, but thinking about how we are just more purposeful about their use.
Yeah.
So we're increasing academic language use. So we're increasing complexity. And I just think that's such an important piece of that.
For sure.
Yeah. I'm just going to add in. Yeah. Like when we work with teachers and when we do, you know, just kind of ongoing coaching and professional learning, we really want teachers to be able to voice why did they choose this one, you know, this one support for a multilingual learner, right? So really that intentionality that Sydney mentioned is so key than just throwing a bunch of sentence stems at them and hoping they work. So really knowing why they're doing it and what they hope to accomplish. And then going back and seeing, was it effective? And what
did
would
it work?
Yeah.
Yep.
So I'll share a couple of discourse strategies. One that we really like is a sequencing activity. And this can be done with a paragraph, or it could be done with a speech or an essay. And the way this is done is the teacher divides up. So if you're doing a paragraph, you have a sentence, sentence strips, basically. And students are asked to work together to put the paragraph in order. And then they're asked to look at why did they put it in that order? What were the clues? So again, we're helping them think about how ideas connect across a passage or across a text. And what are those clues that we use? And sometimes when we're doing this, you know, we have those traditional sequencing words that we rely on: first, second, then next. But we want students to be looking at other clues too, like what's the pronoun use? What do they notice about ideas building on each other? And really start to recognize how that sequencing varies depending on the type of text it is. So that's one strategy. Another is the use of mentor text, which in some ways is similar to the juicy sentence, where students are asked to kind of analyze using guiding questions, the language in a text. And again, you want to be selective in your text. Choose texts that really get at what you're trying to have students work on. What is the focus of that? So if it's cause and effect language, what's the text that you're going to choose about that? And have students analyze that text to think about the language choices the author made, to really think about how they can apply that in their own writing, or how they can approach that if they are approaching a similar text. And then they can recreate their own text, right? Their own examples using that. Maybe you create an anchor chart with those kinds of language functions, and then they can work from that.
Yeah, you know, before we go, those are great examples. Thanks for sharing them. And there's many, many more, obviously, in the book and in the specific chapter, but and really out there everywhere. But I want to emphasize that the intentionality behind all of this, because it's we've used words like anchor chart, sentence stem, asset-based approach. We can go on and on. And those are things that are used and that people know about. I feel like where we take the next level, and I keep going back to this vocabulary list example, but I think it's pertinent. I think where we sometimes stumble is taking the next step, and the next step is that intentionality. And everything that you've brought up goes back to being intentional, not only with the lesson and the unit, but the specific student and what they bring and what they may lack, what they may need, mostly what they bring. And I just really appreciate that. I saw that in the chapter, and I'm hearing it more and more as we kind of dive in. And that's more rare. That's not as common as it should be, I think. What's your take on that? Am I right on that, or am I being too negative?
No, I think you're really true. I think as we see more packaged curriculum, honestly, yeah. And there's so many resources there, right? So it's easier for a teacher to go in, okay, this is what I'm teaching today. And I think that if we don't spend that time at the beginning of a unit really thinking about where we're headed with our students, then we're just not going to support them in making the same kind of language development, right? Yeah. Because we want to be building in these types of activities throughout the unit.
Yeah, and Sydney, just, you know, noticing what Sydney said about the time, right? It does take time, and it's going to take a little bit more time in your planning, really, to have, like Sid mentioned earlier, making sure that it's focused around academic language, but getting into the intentionality behind it. It might take you some extra effort to really drill down on what you're hoping to achieve, and knowing your students, knowing what they come with, but it's really just going to pay off so much in the long run if you can voice the why behind what you're doing in the classroom.
Yeah. I'm getting a little philosophical here, but I can't help but think, like, you know, Sydney, when you talked about these kind of built curriculums, or kind of, I guess I'd consider them kind of plug and play, which really doesn't work very well. It comes back to, and we, you know, we're all sort of in this world of AI now, and things can be done for us, and there's a lot of noise, and what cuts through that noise? What's the signal that cuts through? And it's the humanity. It's the, and that in education, I think, comes through with personalization, differentiation, understanding who your students are, making connections. Over the course of the pandemic, I feel like every other episode that I did was about developing relationships with students and their families. And you're talk without saying that, well, you've said it a few times, but you're talking about that. And I think that's really important. I think it can be hard for us to look at the whole pie or the whole pizza, whatever you want to call it, the recipe that's complete, and not just the ingredients that we need to put in, because sometimes we put in the right ingredients, but it doesn't come out the right way. So anyway, I don't know why I'm getting so philosophical about this, but I really appreciate the intentionality behind all this. I think it's important.
Yeah. Go ahead. Oh, okay. I bet we're going to say the same thing. One thing is that really gets at our intentionality is that we frame our work in this book in our core beliefs around excellent and equitable education for multilingual learners. So we, in the first chapter of the book, we really voice our intentionality and how we frame all of our work. And it's all aligned. It isn't just a separate strategy here, something there. you can't just, you know, like you said, Steve, do plug and play and kind of expect it to work well. It's all got to fit together. It's all got to be aligned. It's all within a framework for our students.
Yep. Yep,
and
for sure.
I just wanted to say, we know how busy teachers are. They have so much on their plates. So we want to, our book is really about trying to support teachers in implementing these strategies in practical ways, knowing how full their plates are. But along those same lines, I think the joy of teaching is really getting students to share themselves, right? Like, and especially our, with our multilingual learners, who we really want to create opportunities for them to share that self. So if we don't create the space for that, then we're going to be missing a huge part of the joy of teaching, I think.
Yep. Yep. Great point. One of the things that I miss the most, I don't, you know, it's those connections that you make along the way. And when I look at my box of letters and things that I got from former students, it's never about that one lesson that I did on that specific topic. It was about the larger impact. And we have to remember that. It's hard day to day, as you know, to remember those things.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's kind of, I hope, what the value that we provide with the podcast and that so many others are doing is just provide that inspiration and just remind people as they're driving to work or as they're doing their dishes or whatever you're doing when you're listening to this right now. So I really appreciate you and all the other guests coming on. But we're not done yet. I feel like I'm about to wrap up, but I'm not. So I would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the resources and the considerations that you have for newcomers and students with limited or formal education, SLIFE students. That's always been a big issue and a big, you know, part of what we do, but it's becoming bigger now as more teachers who have never worked with newcomers or SLIFE students before are need to work with them and have the privilege and excitement of working with them, but need the resources to kind of do what we've been talking about this whole time. So my question is, what advice would you give an educator who may be comfortable, like they got this academic language thing down at the sentence and discourse levels, but how do they sort of level up to, maybe it's not leveling up, but how do they help support teaching newcomers or SLIFE students?
Right. So I think that everything we've been talking about is important for all students, but it becomes particularly important when we're talking about newcomer students or students with interrupted or limited formal education. So we know that it's urgent that we provide them with scaffolding, right? So really thinking about what they need. And then it becomes even more important to be intentional about that language development. So for example, if they need support with like literacy instruction, what is that gonna look like? How are we gonna build that in and really making sure that we're providing that extra support that those students need? Another thing I think is important when we're talking about academic language is being really clear with students about why they need this academic language, right? We know that often those students want the content to feel very relevant. So why are they going to need this academic language? How is it going to help them get a job? How is it going to help them with their goals? So being very explicit about that, I think is really important. And then just working really hard to build those relationships. So we always have that as a foundation.
Yeah. Comes back to the relationships, comes back to understanding what their goals are and just knowing who they are as people and what they want so that we can kind of really help them understand the importance of the language that may seem unnecessary to them, quite frankly, unless we really help them understand if it's out of context, it can be harder to understand. Sorry, Dan, go ahead. I'm sure you're going to say something
right.
A lot more eloquent.
Oh, no. One other piece is when working with, you know, with our newcomers, our students who are newer to English, is practicing academic language topics with non-academic topics first, like really building on knowing what they bring and helping then, you know, getting them comfortable, like sequencing language, for example, like having them talk about their day, for example, and being very well aware of any trauma students might have endured, like making sure we're sticking with topics that, you know, that are going to be accessible to them. And then, you know, gradually increasing the rigor. And just being, you know, being aware of where they are, what time of year, how long they've been with us, and to see at what point we can start pulling back a little bit on some of those scaffolds. Because to see when they can, when they are ready to take the next steps on their own, that's also an art form. And just kind of getting back to what you said earlier about, you know, why we're doing this. In our work, we really want to honor all of the skills and all of the expertise and all of the joy that teachers bring with them. And so, you know, in our work, we really provide a space for teachers to take what they see and to make it their own, you know, for them to be creative and to bring their creativity into, you know, even if we're providing a checklist, we say to teachers all the time, take it, use it, make it your own, you know, like,
yeah,
use these materials, use them as they are, or just adapt them. And hopefully, you know, we know that teachers are doing that. And we love to see examples of how they've taken these materials. So I've kind of gone off on a tangent.
Nope, not a tangent at all. I think that's really important. I want to highlight one thing you said. I love everything you said, but the trauma piece is important for people to understand. There's a lot of resources on that. And, you know, it's not just newcomers who have dealt with trauma. Trauma comes at all levels and at all places. But I think particularly for newcomers, it becomes really important to understand that. We have tons of resources on that in our EL community. So folks can Google that, or not Google it. They can search. I don't know why I said that. They can search for it in our community. We've done podcasts on it as well as put a lot of blog posts and did a lot of work on that, particularly over the course of the pandemic when trauma was something that was still is, but was on everyone's mind. So I'm glad you mentioned that. At one point I talked about how I wanted to get back into this idea of collaboration and not working in silos. And a big part of that is sort of leveraging the different strengths that teachers have to collaborate with one another. And in this case, to collaborate on bringing academic language into content instructions. So I kind of just asked a question without asking a question. How do we do that? How can sort of school, district, instructional leaders at various levels create a system that really leverages? We talk about taking an asset-based approach with our students, but with our teachers as well that work with our students.
Right. And it should be, you know, really, it should be the expectation that this collaboration is going to take place. And it there has to be a time and a space for it. It's got to be built into teachers' schedules. And it's got to be modeled, you know, at the school level and really reinforced. So also, you know, there's got to be a way if we're working, for example, with academic language, we really want to center its use, right? And that the expectation is that all teachers are going to be teaching academic language at the sentence and discourse levels to multilingual learners and to all learners. We want to see models of that in place. We want teachers to be able to have the time to pop into another teacher and observe them, mm-hmm. you know, using some of these strategies for all learners. And it's incredible, you know, how much we can learn from each other in the classroom if we have the time and the space to be able to go and to do that type of collaboration. So it's really got to be ongoing. And, you know, it should be teacher driven. Teachers should also have a very strong voice in what they want to see, what they need, and to have that kind of relationship with their whole school team to be able to voice what it is, what kind of supports they need to be able to strengthen instruction for multilingual learners. Another way that we've seen, and we've been very fortunate in working with some districts on, is developing a strategic plan or a master plan for multilingual learners, which really brings in various stakeholders from the community, not only the school, but also the community, mm-hmm. the school, the district, the community, bringing in parents and students to voice what's important to them to move instruction forward so their students and families feel they belong, that they are a vital part of the school community. So we've seen and, you know, help districts either develop their first master plan or revise a current one. And it's just such a powerful tool to determine your priorities, your action steps, who's going to be involved, and your plan for how to get there, just going beyond academic language to really be more inclusive of our multilingual learners.
Yeah, we have seen that. I've seen that both as an educator myself and here at Elevation, how a master plan or a strategic plan can help you, a good one, can help you incorporate resources and put together strategies that are not just put in place because you happen to have them. That's the case with tech quite a bit. Oh, we have this tool. Let's use it. But, you know, it's like I think it's the Noam Chomsky quote. It's like a hammer. hammer can be used for a variety of different things. It can be used to build a house. It can be used to do harm. We have to figure out, and I think a strategic plan, a master plan does that. It's not just about technology, but like what pieces of the puzzle do you have, where to put them? It's amazing how much better things operate when that's in place. And then the teacher voice also, I think that's really important. It's easier for a teacher to have a voice and to express what they're looking for if they are involved in creating that master plan or strategic plan. Anything to add, Sydney?
I was just thinking about something that I wanted to say for your last question about newcomers and connecting it to this. We haven't really talked about home language use or trans languaging, but I think that's a real, really another important conversation to have as a team, collaboratively, to think about what is the place for home language use and how do we support students in engaging in translanguaging practices so they can continue to develop their home language or their heritage language, and also how are schools committed to supporting that?
Great point. I am tempted to dive down this rabbit hole, but then we're going to be talking for another hour. But it's a really important point. And I was actually going to ask you if there's anything that I didn't ask that I should have asked. And that's a great example of one of those things. Diane, you mentioned it at one point, home language. I remember it being a part of something, but Sydney, you just put it in perspective as something that really needs to be discussed sort of at a higher, more strategic level. And I think that's really important too. And here I am going down the rabbit hole because teachers don't know how to do that, right? There are many teachers, I feel like, think that that's actually not doing the student any good, when the reality is that it's actually quite useful in so many different ways. Maybe more on that in another episode sometime if you want to come back.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about home language use, and also a lot of uncertainty, right? Well, I don't speak their language. What are they?
Yeah.
Maybe they're, how do I know if they're on task or whatever? So I think those are really important conversations to have.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a wide range of you know, in terms of teachers that we work with and how home language is incorporated, if at all, and what, you know, what kind of their underlying beliefs are about its use and when to use more, when to pull back, how to incorporate it. Yeah, just so many questions. So that'll be for our next podcast.
Yeah, I mean, the legacy of English only too just kind of like haunts us in many ways, I think, in many places. I think that's changing, which is great, but the research certainly says that does not work. Okay, so I want to wrap it up here, be respectful of everyone's time, but you have so many resources. Dan, you and I, as I said at the beginning, have sort of gone back and forth through email for a long time, and I know you have early roots in Elevation with Teddy way back. So you've been sort of doing this work along with us for a long time, and Sydney, you both, you as well. So my question is, how can people learn more about the work you're doing, and more specifically, like, where can they go to, I mean, I get your emails, there's tons of information that you send over. So where can they go to get information from you first? If they want to get the book, what's the first step?
Yeah, just one thing I want to just stood out that you said was that I do go way back with Teddy Rice. So way before he even started Elevation, I did a presentation at a TESOL convention, and he approached me at the end. He's like, hey, I've kind of got this idea. I'd love to get your feedback on it. And we kind of went from there. And that was, you know, that was a very long time ago. So I was just so, you know, so thrilled and inspired to see how far you all have come. And, you know, with your intent has always been to support students and teachers. So it's wonderful how well we overlap, you know? So anyway, where can you go? So we have a website, supported.com. So we have just a ton of free material on there. All of our, you know, now we call them printables, but all of, you know, many of our tools, our checklists. We also have, we've done so many free webinars. Those are also on our website, supported.com, through our books. So we have several books now, and growing, not just this one, but previous books, and our, we have, you know, upcoming books as well. As you mentioned, Steve, we do have a newsletter that you can sign up for on our website. So just about every week, we'll send you a free tool or an article or a link to a webinar or, you know, any type of support that we provide teachers. And all of it is free on our website.
Great. Yeah, good stuff. I can vouch for it. I get the emails, and I obviously have read at least, thoroughly one of the chapters in the book. Speaking of books, my last question is a question that we ask everyone, and that is, what are you reading, or what have you read that has had an important influence on you, either personally or professionally, that you might recommend to somebody listening?
Yeah, I can start. So, so this is not a podcast about books. It was really hard. This is like the hardest question Cindy and I was going back and forth.
That's what everyone says. And I'll say at the beginning, I had limited both of you to one, which is cruel of me, but that's where we are.
I know. I'm going between one I read a long time ago and one I read recently. So I think I'm going to go for the long time ago one.
Good.
So way back when I was starting my first teaching job in the U.S., so I had taught previously in Germany and Mexico, but my first job in the U.S. was in rural North Carolina. So I was an ESL teacher out in a trailer that I shared with the speech pathologist. And so at that time, I read Savage Inequalities by Jonathan Cruz, also an oldie, but it just spoke to me. And I'm like, oh, this is what I'm, this is what I'm dealing with. So, it deals with just individual districts and funding and how that looks for students and just such the wide variation that I just lived every day back then when I was teaching out in North Carolina. But at the same time, I had just a wonderful principal who supported my work and who really wanted to do what was right, for the multilingual learner. So that's my book that really kind of influenced who I was, my stance as an ally and an advocate for multilingual learners. So I could choose many more books, but that's the one I'll stick with.
Great. That's a great one. And I appreciate you going back. I think that's always fun. How about you, Sydney?
Yeah, I'm going to share a novel that I read more recently. It's called True Biz by Sarah Novich. And it takes place at a boarding school for deaf students.
Huh.
And what I love about this novel is the author does a lot to integrate history of ASL, history of deaf culture, variations on ASL. So I just found it an amazing reminder of the complexities of culture, the complexities of language, and how much we really need to be learning about our students. And I also saw her, I watched a Q&A that she did, and she talked about part of her reason for writing the book, where she was in Philadelphia and she came across a group of students who were signing, and she talked about feeling at home, that feeling of home. And I think that's something in our work with students and families we want to be cultivating for them, right? What can we do to really, Diane talked about that sense of belonging. And I think we do it through the materials, the curriculum materials we choose, by, like we said, tapping into that background knowledge, creating a space where families have an opportunity to share with us their concerns and questions. And I just think that's so important of a goal to hold on to in our work.
Beautiful. Well, two very different books. I've read Savage Inequalities. I have not read True Biz. Is that the name of it?
True Biz. And it is slang in ASL to mean like seriously.
Okay, cool. Good. I didn't know. That's kind of why I was saying, it's why I questioned the title, but now I know. And they, so it's great. So those are two, one oldie and one sort of newer one. And hopefully, I'm sure that there'll be somebody who will pick up at least one of those books.
I started reading True Biz over the weekend. Couldn't put it down.
I was just going to say, like, I think, and I've said this before probably too many times in the podcast, but like, one of the reasons why I do this is pretty selfish. Just so I can, the books behind me that you see are likely many recommendations from podcast guests. So between the books that I get to read that you all write and the recommendations, I'm pretty set with my reading library. Well, with that, Sydney, Diane, it was really, really great to catch up. I'm glad we finally did this, and I look forward to following Support Ed and the work you're doing moving forward and sort of collaborating in the future. And hopefully we'll do this again. I really had fun. I learned a lot.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, really. Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations. If you liked our show, please be sure to join the ELL community at elevationeducation.com/ELL community, where you'll find all the episodes of Highest Aspirations and other resources to help educators maximize the impact on their English language learners. Also, let us know how we're doing by writing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.